Officials with the Los Angeles County Coroner were working to release the names of all nine people aboard the helicopter that crashed into a hillside in Calabasas. And the NTSB's GO team has been on scene for a few days. During that time, media outlets were in a feeding frenzy for information about who was on board and why the helicopter crashed.
I really could not believe my eyes at some of the things that I was seeing, some of the recklessness from some reporters.
I'm Steve Gregory in Los Angeles, and this is the death and life of Kobe Bryant. Sports journalist Larry Brown remembers getting a text alert on the morning of the crash.
I've been doing this long enough where I have a detector as to whether or not I believe stories, whether or not I need to investigate more, whether they could be true or not. And everything about this one signaled to me, oh my goodness, this is real.
Brown owns and operates the website LarryBrownSports.com and says he went into reporter mode immediately following an alert from TMZ Sports.
I knew right away that this story was massive with gigantic implications and was going to be huge. And from that point on, I was locked in on the computer for several hours straight, just trying to type away different stories, adding updates, organizing. When big stories like this happen, I want to have the most thorough, complete, and accurate coverage possible. And I want people knowing that they could come to my website for reliable content. And I was just locked in, and I probably didn't come up for air for the next 7 hours or so.
Brown says he remembers the overwhelming amount of information and knew this was a lot to process.
You remember at first, the first thing was to confirm, did this actually happen? Did Kobe Bryant really die in this helicopter crash? Then it was, how did it happen? Who was aboard? How many died? And for a few hours, it was just about getting those actual raw details and facts about the story. And so I saw so much of this information being shared. I remember going through every step of this process as some of this stuff was unsure, and just seeing the way some of it unfolded and the way some outlets reported things was very concerning. I really could not believe my eyes at some of the things that I was seeing, some of the recklessness from some reporters, not understanding the ramifications of what they were doing when they threw out information that turned out to be incorrect. So I know I wrote it. I felt at the time that it was an important part of the story to share was how bad some of the media coverage was, and kind of just to put it out there as a reminder, like, hey, this story is too big, has too much gravity to get some of these important things wrong.
But then Brown says he noticed more and more sloppy reporting by media outlets.
There were several passengers aboard, and there are people involved here who would like to know whether or not their loved one has actually died, and you can't be giving them bad information. That's you're toying with a lot of people's emotions. It's inappropriate. And so I remember just going through that and just thinking I needed to write about it.
Hours after the crash, Brown would write about the sloppy reporting, the bad TV live shots, and the blatantly wrong information being broadcast around the world. Even the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department posted a poorly written tweet that read, 5 people confirmed deceased, no survivors in Calabasas helicopter crash.
All the LA County Sheriff's Department had to do was say, at least 5 confirmed dead, or we know that there have been 5 people confirmed dead so far. At least some way of saying it so that we knew that it was not only 5, but we know of 5 so far, because it seemed more definitive the way they presented it, as if that was it. And that was problematic. So I think the language that they used, they should have been much more careful with the way they did it. I thought, you know, there was a reporter, it was really bad. ABC's Matt Gutman was on air. And I understand when you're live on air that you don't have a script in front of you, that you're talking off the top of your head, and it leaves open the possibility for errors. But that's where you have to be more vigilant and be on top of things. You cannot possibly go on air and say something to the entire country of the nature of, I have heard, or there is talk, that all four of Kobe's children were on board. That's not something you can say on that kind of a platform so casually without having that confirmed. I thought that was really, really poor reporting, poor judgment. And that's the kind of catastrophic error to me. That's you know, I couldn't have someone working for me if they would make an error that big. It shows such poor judgment in the most important times when you can't prepare. That was really bad.
One of the earliest rumors was that former Lakers teammate and friend of Bryant, Rick Fox, was among those who died in the crash.
The Rick Fox example, that to me is the quintessential. So the Rick Fox thing, that's not a professional doing something wrong. Like a professional reporter on TV who is ad-libbing, they're showing poor judgment and poor skill by just blabbing something out there of that nature that's incorrect. That's poor professionalism. And in my opinion, if I were running a station, that's grounds for firing. The Rick Fox is an example of amateurs doing something wrong. That's social media taking over and doing wrong, because that one completely originated on social media with someone just throwing something out there on Twitter, and then it just snowballs from there. People who don't have any consequences to their actions. Like for me, if I write something, there are consequences for me. If I publish a story, I could be sued. If you go on air and say something, if you're a reporter, you can be suspended, fired, you could be found liable. There are consequences. For any random person on Twitter, there are no consequences. So they could just see a story and just retweet it. And the retweets spread so much faster than the corrections. And that's what happened with Rick Fox. That was just a classic example of social media running rampant with a rumor. It had no basis in reality. The origins of that do not trace back to any venerable reporter. No media outlet reported it. It was just a pure social media rumor that just spread to the point. I remember getting a message from my uncle saying, "Hey, I heard Rick Fox may have died too." I was like, "No, that's just total crap." I couldn't believe how it spread, but it just shows that people don't verify before tweeting because they don't have consequences. And then just false information can completely go viral as a result.
One of the more controversial stories that came out that day was from Washington Post political reporter Felicia Sanmez. Sanmez's first tweet about the crash was simply a link to a 2016 Daily Beast article on the 2003 felony sexual assault case against Bryant. Brown retweeted it with the comment, "Sanmez decided now would be a good time to bring up Kobe Bryant's rape case, and it ended up setting the record for biggest ratio in Twitter history." And then she doubled and tripled down, lecturing others for responding negatively.
Well, I think it is important to include it as part of Bryant's story, and it is. But the way I view it is, one of the core tenets of journalism is fairness. And if someone just died in a helicopter crash who was beloved, who meant so much to a city and to the world, and who accomplished so much, I think it's really important to be fair and to view everything all together. And what part of the entire picture of what Kobe Bryant did for the world and why he was remembered, what portion of it is that case in Colorado, and what portion of it is the positive impact he had on people's lives, on the sport, on fans? And I think it's important to try and rank it all and put it into a context. And for me, if you are leading with that as the first thing when you talk about Kobe, I don't think that's being fair to his entire legacy as a human being. If you bury it as the very last thing you say, or you omit it entirely, that's not being fair either. I think it's important to put it in its proper context. And to me, when I evaluate the whole thing, when I look at Kobe Bryant and what he did, I think if you are looking at Kobe's life as of whatever it was, 2003 or 2004, I think it was a big part of his story at that point. I think a lot of his story was he was, you know, born to a former pro basketball player. He grew up in Italy. He was drafted straight out of high school. He was a young player picked by wound up going to the Lakers. He came off the bench, he won a few championships, and he's got this big case. But there was so much time that happened after that, and so many more things that he accomplished, and so many good things that he started to do. He became a family man. He had all these children. He was being a positive role model for them. He had gone into filmmaking. He had his Mamba mentality that he was trying to influence other basketball players. He was trying to bring a lot more attention to women's sport and empower females in athletics. And there were so many more things that he had done and so many more accomplishments he had made that it starts to push that down further. And there's just so much more to his story. And so I think it ranks in there, but I don't think it's at the top, and I don't think it should be omitted, but it does have its place. And the question is, where are you placing it? And I think you got to talk about all the positive things that he, all the positive impact he had on the world, first and foremost, while then also including and saying that that is part of his legacy as well. And also, you know, quite frankly, being truthful about the situation, that Kobe always maintained that he was innocent and that any encounter was consensual. And I think it's important to include that information too. So it's just a matter of how you, you know, I think if you omit it, you're doing it wrong. And I think if you make that the sole focus, I think you're doing it wrong as well. And that those were my problems, were the people who said you should omit it and the people who said you should lead with it and make it the only focus. To me, either direction, you're showing an agenda that's unfair. And I think you just need to be fair about the situation and include it where you feel it's part of his entire story, where it ranks in his entire story as a human.
Sanmez's tweet got her suspended. She also received death threats and had to stay in a hotel. Coming up, Bryant and his daughter get a Hollywood-style send-off. And still to come, Bryant's death leaves a void in the Black community as the death and life of Kobe Bryant continues. On the evening of the crash, the Grammy Awards happened in downtown Los Angeles. We touched on it in episode 2. But what people don't know is the voice of the Grammys would become the voice of the memorial.
Everyone was just a person grieving. It just felt really warm and beautiful.
Ellen Kay is best known for her popular morning show at KOST-FM in Los Angeles, but she's also very well known for her high-profile voiceover work for major award shows and TV specials. She remembers the morning of the crash. She was getting ready for her job as the announcer for the Grammy Awards at Staples Center.
So this is early, early morning that day. And so I said to my husband, hey, will you be my chauffeur? We're going to fake it. I'm going to drive myself because I've got a parking pass down to Staples. My call time's not until 10. So just pretend like you're my chauffeur and drive me to the Grammys. So we're making a video. We're having fun. I pulled back in the driveway with my husband, got out. My son met us at the driveway and said, Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter accident. I just saw it on TMZ. And at first I'm like, there's no way. The TMZ's been hacked. That's what I thought. So my phone started, you know, alerting me, ringing, texts, buzz, buzz, buzz. So it was Ken Ehrlich and his team at the Grammys. Ken, then Ron, saying, get down here immediately. We only have a few hours. We've got to scrap parts of the show. And, you know, it's interesting, Steve, the day before was Alicia Keys' birthday, and she was so excited to be hosting the Grammys. And it was all lighthearted fun, and, you know, she had all the outfits rolling in. It was just going to be an awards show. So to then realize, oh, the news is true. I listened to KFI on my way down as everything was unfolding. And, you know, you guys kept me up to all the details that you had that up until that moment when I pulled into the belly of the Staples Center. And it was so still, which is crazy for a giant, I mean, the Grammys, there's so much movement usually, but everything was still, and I'll never forget that stillness. It was just everybody devastated, crying, you know, red faces, tears, just tears everywhere. And Alicia Keys was with the producers, and they were planning what they were going to do. And I thought it came out beautifully with Boys to Men and what she said. And she's so perfect for that moment, because she just wanted to speak from her heart, which is what she did. You know, there were no scripts. There was nothing. It was just, you know, Alicia, you're the host. You can do this. You'll do a great job. You can bring us all together.
Coming up, little did Ellen Kay realize her longtime work with the producers of the Grammy Awards would lead to a very unexpected call as the death and life of Kobe Bryant continues. Nationally syndicated radio personality Kurt Alexander, otherwise known as Big Boy, was a close friend of Bryant's. Bryant was a frequent in-studio guest on Alexander's morning show called Big Boy's Neighborhood in Los Angeles.
To actually get up that day and know that you were getting dressed to go to a Kobe Bryant memorial felt different, because I'm so used to going to Staples Center celebrating Kobe Bryant at the Staples Center. And I got so much happiness with concerts and everything at the Staples Center. Laker basketball with Kobe Bryant at the Staples Center. The last game he played at the Staples Center, I'm there. So to actually, when I was in line with my wife, we had that conversation, and it was like, baby, how crazy does this feel? You know, we've walked into the Staples Center with thousands upon thousands of people cheering Kobe Bryant on. And when you walked in that day, it was just a feeling that you never thought that you would have in the Staples Center before.
Well-known radio host and professional voiceover artist Ellen Kay remembers the day she heard about the crash. She was about to do her job as the announcer of the Grammy Awards that night. A few weeks later, Ellen would get another call and another job.
Well, the Kobe Bryant Memorial was produced by the same Grammy producers, Ken Ehrlich and Ron Basile. And they called me one night after they had just left Vanessa's house, and they said, we are putting together a memorial, and Vanessa's asked us to do it. We would like to have you voice it. Do you think that's something you would be up for? She wants a female voice. We suggested you, and she said yes. So we're asking you, can you? And I said, absolutely, I will be there.
Did this invitation feel any different?
Yes. Yeah. And I'll tell you why. These guys are friends of mine. I've worked with them for so many years. This time it was just the two of them. It wasn't their team. No one else was reaching out. It wasn't the usual, hey, can you come back this year or anything like that? It was them on the phone and conference together. And so when I got the call, it was in the evening, and I thought, oh, wow, it's Ken and Ron. And they were, you know, on the line. I think Ron said, hang on, I'm going to patch Ken in. And then they explained where they had just been. And you could just hear it in their voices. Like they had a job to do for Vanessa, for our city, for everyone who loves Kobe, for the world. And I thought it was a really beautiful memorial. You know, I didn't even think about it. I did the radio show here at Coast and then left a little early, about an hour early, and my husband picked me up, and he drove me down, dropped me off, and there was Jeannie Buss, and we walked down the tunnel quietly together, and she was inconsolable, understandably so. And then there was no one backstage yet. There were some people who were being seated. There were a lot of people outside and a lot of air traffic. But then again, there's that stillness in the big place, like under the Staples Center. It's just, you know, and Jeannie went to a corner under the rafters, and she sat on a chair with her phone all alone. She stayed there until until Jay-Z came along and he walked by, kind of did a head nod. And then I realized, oh, there are going to be a lot of people like him here today. I didn't even think about who might be there. And when they gave me the run of show, I saw that Beyonce was opening and saw, you know, who was performing. And it was a simple script. And they took me to the visiting locker room where there was a microphone. Then they later brought a monitor. And a part that I thought was really, it kind of brought some levity to the day is Phil Jackson really needed to pee. And so he was standing right outside the visiting locker room because I was right as you walk onto the floor and he knocked. And I went to the door and opened and he said, oh, I'm so sorry. I said, no, go on in. I left the room. And so he had the whole locker room to himself. That happened multiple times. Shaq also. And there were a couple other people who had to go use the bathroom. I'm trying to remember who it was, but there were just so many, you know, celebrities there. Vanessa used my voiceover booth to change Capri's diaper, and she was quiet but calm. But it was Michael Jordan at the teleprompter monitor that really got me, because I've never seen anyone cry and sob like he did. And we were all alone back there with one other producer. I was changing shoes from sneakers into heels, and I was barefoot when he walked up and he wanted to read through the teleprompter. He goes, oh, I know a lot about shoes. That is such a great line. So there, we were laughing, and then he started reading what he said at the memorial, and he had to stop, and his whole body was shaking, and I handed him a box of tissues.
He wanted to be the best basketball player that he could be. And as I got to know him, I wanted to be the best big brother that I could be. I took great pride as I got to know Kobe Bryant that he was just trying to be a better person, a better basketball player. We talked about business. We talked about family. We talked about everything. And he was just trying to be a better person. In the game of basketball, in life, as a parent, Kobe left nothing in the tank. He left it all on the floor. No one knows how much time we have. That's why we must live in the moment. We must enjoy the moment. We must reach and see and spend as much time as we can with our families and friends and the people that we absolutely love. To live in the moment means to enjoy each and every one that we come in contact with. When Kobe Bryant died, a piece of me died. And as I look in this arena and across the globe, a piece of you died. I will live with the memories of knowing that I had a little brother that I tried to help in every way I could. Please rest in peace, little brother.
And it's amazing. I've never been that close to Michael Jordan before. I was standing right next to him and I didn't know really what to do. I wanted to hug him. I didn't know him. I didn't want to, you know, break a boundary or get in his space, but he stopped and then started again. And Shaq walked up and they ribbed each other. And Shaq was asked, do you want us to put your speech in the teleprompter? He said, no, I'm going to keep it in my pocket. So his was handwritten on a piece of paper and he put it in his pocket.
When I have imagined speaking to a group of people about Kobe Bryant, I usually picture in the context of his Hall of Fame induction or as a guest speaker at one of Kobe and Vanessa's foundation event. But never, ever could I have imagined that I'd be here today speaking at his memorial. And it pains me to my core.
Ellen also remembers the minutes leading up to the beginning of the show.
When I put my headphones on, we were getting ready to go, and I'm looking at my monitor, that all the lights went down in the house, and my mic was live, and I didn't know it. And Beyonce was in place, and they told me, okay, wait. So I'm listening to them in my headset, and Ken Ehrlich asked me, are you ready? And I said, yes. and it went all through the house. No, I said, ready. And it went all through the house. And then they said, you're live, go. So you hear this ready. And then we started. And it was just something that I can't really remember. It's hard to describe. My feet, couldn't feel my feet. And look, I'm there on the crew, but it was just that it was such a small operation compared to what we had just done a month earlier. It was really literally two guys and, of course, sound engineer, teleprompter, lights. It was all within one table backstage and then me in a locker room. It brought us closer together, that's for sure.
Alicia Keys played Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, a song that Bryant himself learned to play on piano for his wife, Vanessa. Ellen Kay says host Jimmy Kimmel had a tough time getting through the show.
I want to thank everyone for being here, and thank you for gathering to celebrate the lives of Alyssa Altobelli, her parents, John and Carrie Altobelli, Peyton Chester, her mother, Sarah Chester, Christina Mauser, Ara Zabayan, Gigi Bryant, and her father, Kobe Bryant. This is a sad day, but it is also a celebration of life, of their lives. I don't think any of us could have imagined this.
And after the teammates and mentors spoke, it was time to hear from Bryant's wife, Vanessa.
Thank you all so much for being here. It means so much to us. The outpouring of love and support that my family has felt from around the world has been so uplifting. Thank you so much for all your prayers. I'd like to talk about both Kobe and Gigi, but I'll start with my baby girl first. My baby girl. We will not be able to see Gigi go to high school with Natalia and ask her how her day went. We didn't get the chance to teach her how to drive a car. I won't be able to tell her how gorgeous she looks on her wedding day. I'll never get to see my baby girl walk down the aisle, have a father-daughter dance with her daddy, dance on the dance floor with me, or have babies of her own. Gianna would have been an amazing mommy. She was very maternal ever since she was really little. Gigi would have most likely become the best player in the WNBA. She would have made a huge difference. I have no idea how I deserved a man that loved and wanted me more than Kobe. He even handmade my most treasured gifts. He just thought outside the box and was so thoughtful, even while working hard to be the best athlete. He gifted me the actual notebook and the blue dress Rachel McAdams wore in the Notebook movie. When I asked him why he chose the blue dress, he said it was because it's a scene when Allie comes back to Noah. We had hoped to grow old together like the movie. We really had an amazing love story. We loved each other with our whole beings, Two perfectly imperfect people making a beautiful family and raising our sweet and amazing girls. God knew they couldn't be on this earth without each other. He had to bring them home to heaven together. Babe, you take care of our Gigi. And I got Nani, Bibi, and Coco. We're still the best team. We love and miss you, Boo Boo and Gigi. May you both rest in peace and have fun in heaven until we meet again one day. We love you both and miss you forever and always. Mommy.
Coming up in episode 5.
Even good pilots can end up in bad situations.
A cause of the crash has been determined, and still to come, Bryant's impact in the art world. The Death and Life of Kobe Bryant is a production of KFI News at iHeart Media Los Angeles for the iHeart Podcast Network.